You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 24th of April, 2024 on Monocle Radio. It's 1900 in Beijing, 1400 in Kyiv, midday here in London and 7am in Washington, DC. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, broadcasting to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme, we get the details of the US aid package approved by Congress last night, as Chuck Schumer, Majority Leader of the House, confirms.
A lot of people inside and outside the Congress wanted this package to fail. But today, those in Congress who stand on the side of democracy are winning the day.
We'll have a roundup of business news, and we join celebrated novelist Monica Ali as she reveals the shortlisted books of the Women's Prize for Fiction. And the painter Caravaggio died in mysterious circumstances in 1610. We'll hear all about his last painting, The Martyrdom of St. Ursula.
There is also an image of Caravaggio itself. It seems like the last signature in a painting, and you will see probably what is the feeling of a man that is probably ready to pass away.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Georgina Godwin. Yesterday, the US Senate approved $95 billion of foreign aid that includes military support for Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan. President Joe Biden is expected to sign the legislation into law today. Well, I'm joined now by Paul Rogers, Open Democracy's and international security expert. Paul, thanks for coming back on the show. Now, this was passed by the US House of Representatives on Saturday, clearing the way for a Senate vote. But it has been delayed for months. Can you describe its rather torturous route through legislation and why there was a change of heart?
It's not easy, I must admit, but certainly within Congress, there were many Republicans who were pretty bitterly opposed to particular parts of it, especially the aid to Ukraine. And there were various devices used to try and delay it and even get rid of it. Ultimately, the Speaker, Mike Johnson, was quite crucial in this, in the way the whole thing was framed. And the Republican leader also sort of tried to set the sides at ease to some extent within the Republican Party, but with some difficulty, and tempers were really raised. One of the reasons it eventually went through was that it's in four parts, as you mentioned, three of them, Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan. And then the fourth was a rather openly worded section, which was really allowing the possibility of banning TikTok, the media sensation, unless the ownership of it came into the United States from China. And that was really a softener for the hard right, if you like. But the point is that all four of those different scopes were put into a single motion. So essentially, it was a kind of take it or leave it. And even if some of the members of Congress bitterly opposed some bits, other bits they were quite happy with. So this is a consequence of how it got through. Interestingly, once it got through, its passing through the Senate was extraordinary. It was a vote of 79 to 18. So sort of 4-1 pass. And incidentally, there were three members of Senate, liberals, who were actually opposed to it, including Bernie Sanders. And that was on the grounds of the support for Israel that they feel is actually wrong because of the huge loss of life that's being incurred in the Israeli involvement in Gaza. Mm. So it's a complicated story, but it cut through a combination of sort of rather crude politics, but it took 6 months to do it.
How much of the package goes to Ukraine and what will it be used for? I noticed that US officials are urging Ukrainians to use it to consolidate their lines and hold tight rather than rush another counteroffensive. How will that be achieved?
Well, in terms of the proportions of the $95 billion, in rounded terms, Ukraine has $61 billion, Israel has $26 and a bit billion, and Taiwan and sort of Southeast Asia, West Pacific, has $26 billion. So Ukraine is overwhelmingly the largest bit, essentially about two-thirds. Interestingly, most of the aid going to Ukraine and Israel, in other words, most of all of it, is actually going to be spent internally in the United States. So in other words, it will be used to buy arms to send to these countries. And in fact, one leading senator, Marquay Mullen of Oklahoma, actually made this point, and it's one of the reasons why he was prepared to accept it, because much of the money doesn't even leave the country, although, of course, the equipment does. But essentially, Ukraine gets this. The opposition to Ukraine getting the money comes mainly from right-wing Republicans, particularly in Congress, who basically think this is an unwinnable war. There has to be a settlement. Many of them sort of took the Trump line of being sort of quite rather closer in some ways to the Russian side. And they were really of a mind to oppose it right the way through. But they were in a sufficiently small minority not to count. So in a long answer to your quick question, Ukraine, it's mostly weapons, particularly anti-aircraft weapons, but also some modern systems as well for sort of ground-to-ground fighting.
And might those weapons, particularly the ATACMS 300 medium-range missiles, could those be a game-changer for Ukraine?
It's a difficult one. The ATACMS, as you say, is an important weapon. It's an area impact weapon. In other words, it can kill people and damage so-called soft targets over wide areas. And its range is much longer than the current system they have. I think it's about three times as long. But it is an accurate system. So, yes, I doubt it'll be a game-changer. We've heard so many game-changer reports over the last 2 years. But the reality is it pushes things a little bit on the Ukrainian side, particularly if they're trying to lay into targets in, well, say, the eastern part of Ukraine, bordering on Russia, which Russia controls, and in Crimea. But the problem still remains with Ukraine. This is a war which neither side can win, but neither side will lose. And at some stage, it has to end in negotiated settlements. And to that extent, quite a lot of people privately will agree with those Republican right-wingers. They may be pro-Moscow in some ways, following the Trump line, but actually the war does have to come to an end through negotiation. And in some ways, this may produce a kind of balance, which means that negotiations can happen. But that's a very positive way of looking at it, I have to say.
Mm. And Paul, what about aid to Israel?
Well, this, of course, is important for the Israelis. We're in this quite extraordinary position at the moment that Biden is really putting a lot of pressure on the Israelis to get some sort of ceasefire, at least temporary, and allow much more aid into Gaza. But on the other hand, the United States is also putting, $26 billion of aid, supplementary aid for weapons, very largely for weapons, into Israeli hands. Now, to give you an idea, $26 billion is about equivalent to one-third of the total defence spending of either Britain or Germany or France. So we're dealing with very large amounts of money. And it's certainly true that Israel would sort of have to find a way of bringing the war to an end if the United States pulled the plug. And so you have this situation at the moment, the United States wanting lots of aid to go in, but also in some ways giving Israel the weapons, which produces a greater need for aid. It's a crazy situation, but that's because Biden in many ways is trying to satisfy two very different groups within the body politic of the United States.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. That was Paul Rogers there. Now here's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. The EU has called on international donors to resume funding to Gaza's largest UN agency. It comes after a review found that Israel had not provided evidence for its claim that thousands of UNRWA staff were members of terror groups. Several countries had halted funding to the agency after allegations that some employees took part in the Hamas attacks on Israel. Australian police have arrested 7 teenagers as part of a wave of counter-terrorism raids across Sydney, claiming it was likely the youths may have been plotting an attack. Police say the suspects are believed to share a religiously motivated violent extremist ideology. The raids are linked to last week's stabbing of a bishop, which police declared a terrorist act. And pro-Palestinian protesters have refused to disband from Columbia University's main campus after a midnight deadline was set by the institution's president. Demonstrators were warned alternative options would have to be considered for clearing the area on the New York City campus if an agreement was not reached. A group representing pro-Palestinian protesters said it would not continue engaging in negotiations. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Georgina.
Thank you, Carlotta. Well, it's time now for a business roundup with Victoria Scholar, Head of Investment at Interactive Investor. Victoria, thanks for coming on the show. Let's start with Tesla. I understand the shares surged last night, but that's kind of counterintuitive.
Yes, that's right. So we saw that shares in Tesla jump by more than 13% after hours, helping to reverse some of this year's heavy selling. Investors were shrugging off a first quarter miss in terms of profit and revenues. Instead, they were focused on the electric vehicle maker's plans to accelerate the rollout of a cheaper car, with production of new models being brought forward from late 2025 to later this year instead. So Elon Musk is clearly hoping that a lower priced model will boost demand for electric vehicles, which have been slowing globally.
I mean, what's odd is, of course, both Tesla and X, formerly Twitter, are owned by the same person, Elon Musk. There was a report by Reuters about Tesla, and on X, they said Tesla said Reuters is lying on their X forum without pointing out any inaccuracies. This all seems very odd.
Well, I think Elon Musk is no stranger to controversy, and he's also always very happy to speak his mind. But you're right. I think one of the issues that Tesla's facing is that Elon Musk is spread too thinly. He's got other companies as well, the Boring Company, SpaceX, and others. So perhaps he might have taken his eye off the ball a bit, and that could be contributing to why Tesla shares have been struggling so much this year. It's also been dealing with stiff competition from China, of course, and broader, slower EV demand and pressures from higher interest rates as well.
Mm. Let's have a look at Gucci, the parent company Kering have plunged today. Shares in Kering have plunged today. Why is that?
Well, it warned that its first half profit is going to drop by between 40 and 45%, which already sounds pretty big, but it was actually even bigger than analysts had penciled in. It also reported sales down 10% in the first quarter, and its key luxury brand, Gucci, suffered an 18% slide in sales. Now, it's been struggling with difficult market conditions, particularly in China, where demand has been slowing down. But it can't all be explained away by China. I think there's also the impact of how fashionistas shift their preferences. And Gucci was very much the brand of the moment for quite a while. But now it seems as though those fashionistas have moved on, because we've seen that other luxury conglomerates like LVMH and Hermes have held up much, much better than Kering.
Mm. Let's have a look at Lloyds Bank. They've reported a 28% slump in profits.
Yes, that's right. And this is partly because Lloyds did pretty well last year on the back of rising interest rates, which means that it can earn more from loans. But still, it did see a 28% slump in its first quarter pre-tax profit, which was short of analyst forecasts. Net interest income, which is a measure of how much it earns from loans versus how much it pays out to savers, also fell sharply by about 10%. It's been dealing with higher borrowing costs, which means that there's less demand for mortgages and other business loans. And also people have been shifting out of cash in their current accounts and moving more into savings instead. So Lloyds is having to pay more interest to customers on its savings products.
And are they under pressure from politicians and perhaps regulators too to pass on interest rates to savers at the same rate?
Yeah, well, this is always a contentious issue because banks are typically very quick to pass on higher interest rates from the Bank of England to lend or to borrowers in terms of higher mortgage rates and higher business loans. But they're less quick to pass on that benefit to people by putting up their savings rates. So that is something that is always closely watched and monitored, like you say, by regulators and politicians.
Victoria, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. This week, the National Gallery in London has opened its one painting exhibition of Caravaggio's final work, The Martyrdom of St. Ursula, from 1610. The painting is well known to the world and has travelled and been exhibited widely, but people know almost nothing about its current owner, the largest bank in Italy, Intesa San Paolo. Michele Coppola, who's director of cultural development of Intesa San Paolo, popped by Midori House to talk to Monocle's Tom Webb about the history of their collection and how it came into existence.
The idea is to be a cultural player, but what I want to underline is that being a cultural player from the point of view of a private company supporting the cultural public institution, and it happens in Italy, probably the most important country worldwide for its heritage, for its public collections, and probably for the network of museums all across Italy. And this is what I want to underline. Being a private company, but behaving like a cultural international institution.
Now that leads us very nicely to why you are here in London. Can you give us a purpose of your visit, please?
Yes. First of all, I would like to thank Gabriele Finaldi, the director of National Gallery, and the National Gallery itself. We are friends. Gallerie d'Italia are friends with National Gallery across the years. And I think that it's really meaningful to be here because of their anniversary. And thinking about this exhibition, this very welcome free exhibition dedicated to the last Caravaggio, because of the anniversary of National Gallery on May the 10th, with the painting from Gallerie Italia owned by a private company that has become a cultural player, means a lot to us for sure, but also to demonstrate how art and culture is a way of being not only of the public bodies or public museums, but also it's a way of being of companies, of countries, and being here to be as guest at the anniversary of one of the most important museums in the world, talking about an Italian artist, I think it's a very meaningful thing to share, and also a reason for inviting people to go to National Gallery and to visit the dialogue between the two paintings from the two paintings by Caravaggio, one from Gallerie Italia and the other one from National Gallery.
So it's referred to as a single painting exhibition, but that's simply because they've already got one. So people can expect two.
Yeah, exactly. It's an exhibition dedicated to the last moment of Caravaggio. The last Caravaggio is exactly the last moment in his life. And the paintings themselves and the dialogue between the two paintings set up at the National Gallery gives us probably the feeling about that moment that Caravaggio was living. And also the strength, the power of that images. I think it will be a very appreciated exhibition. What we called in Italy a small exhibition, but meaningfully, for sure.
And for the purposes of this medium, it's radio. Can you paint us a picture of the last Caravaggio? It's one of the most striking images I've seen.
Well, yeah, it's really difficult to use the right words to talk about that painting and that image. Well, the strength of Caravaggio and the power of Caravaggio was to go directly to the point. The message is clear. And the realistic way of talking about people, their lives, I think it's one of the most interesting way of painting of one of the most famous artists across the years. And the Martyrdom of St. Ursula, it's his last painting. And there is also an image of Caravaggio itself. It seems like the last signature in a painting. And You will see probably what is the feeling of a man that, I don't know how, is probably ready to pass away. And so it's another reason to go to the National Gallery to visit the exhibition.
And it's quite a large painting, yeah. Very, very valuable.
Yeah,
how are you transporting across the world?
Well, good question. It's always a serious matter, moving works of art, especially when we're talking about really valuable works of art. And of course, we need the expertise of selected companies that are allowed to move works of art like that. And also moving a painting that is a painting under the control of the government, what we call in Italy soprintendenze, you have to be allowed to move that painting. Even if you are moving it for a cultural reason, even if you are talking about cultural initiatives, exhibitions and so on. But of course, we are talking about a cultural asset that, of course, has its own market value, but because of its importance, its cultural importance. And so you have to pay the attention. And the painting itself travel with a courier. That means with the person that are involved in paying attention to the painting and also that authorize every single activities dedicated to the painting itself. Opening, of course, the boxes and also when it need to be hung on the wall. Always the person authorized from Galleria d'Italia, of course, that can assist the museum and the operator of National Gallery in setting up the exhibition for the visitors.
We've spoken about logistics. Why don't we talk about what else you've got coming up beyond The Last Caravaggio? Perhaps you've got a new exhibition coming up in Naples. What does 2024 look like for the rest of the year?
Well, of course, I need probably more than 1 hour to talk about things that are going to happen in Galleria d'Italia in Milano, Torino, Naples and Vicenza. For sure, let me tell you that with National Gallery, I think it's important to share this information, we are welcoming two paintings by Velázquez from National Gallery itself because of this friendship. The idea is to offer to visitors of Galleria d'Italia in Naples something that comes from London. The idea in friendship is, of course, to share things, also to share works of art. And what we call guest of honor is another small way of promoting art and culture. Also talking about Velázquez and its journey to Naples. And what we have found in our archive was, of course, documents related to his journey to Naples and to the building, the Banco di Napoli. And so it's important to keep on working with cultural institutions such as the National Gallery in London.
Michele Coppola speaking to Monocle's Tom Webb. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, the Women's Prize Trust, the UK charity which creates equitable opportunities for women in the world of books, announced the shortlist for the 2024 Women's Prize for Fiction today. Now, in its 29th year and sponsored by Audible and Bailey's, the Women's Prize for Fiction shines a spotlight on outstanding, ambitious, original fiction written in English by women from anywhere in the world. The chair of the judges, Monica Ali, whose debut novel Brick Lane was nominated for the Booker Prize, joins me to discuss the list now. Monica, it's wonderful to have you on this programme. I wonder if you could tell me about the overall feel of these final six books.
I mean, they're each original and unique, so it's quite hard to sum them up. But overall, I would say that they form a testament to the power of women's writing. They're gloriously compelling narratives with indelible characters, exquisite prose, emotional heft, and original insight into the human condition.
And now there's a spread of nationalities, Irish, American, British, and also French. Let's have a look at some at the people on the shortlist. We start with, of course, a very well-known and accomplished novelist, and that's Anne Enright. Tell us a little bit about The Wren.
Well, it explores the messy, frequently fraught relationship between Carmel and her daughter Nell, and the long shadow thrown over the entire family by Carmel's famous poet father, Phil. And Enright just writes exquisite sentences. I mean, it's awe-inducing. She evokes such a range of emotions, trauma, anger, resentments, even violence, but also she's brilliant at depicting the river of love that flows beneath it all. It's really a dazzling achievement.
And the book Brotherless Night.
Brotherless Night is by Vibhi Ganeshanantham, and it's an account of the Sri Lankan Civil War that really centres women's experience of the war. So the protagonist is called Sashi. She has four brothers. They all have bright futures ahead of them. Sashi herself is determined to become a doctor, an ambition actually that she fulfils despite the war that breaks out. But all of her brothers become, in very different ways, lost to her because of the conflict. It's a searing, it's a deeply moving novel that bears witness to the suffering and the brutality of all sides. It's unflinching in its commitment to the complexity and has a clear-eyed moral scrutiny. And I promise you that if you read it, you will never forget it.
Oh, stunning praise indeed. We go on now to the Australian writer Kate Grenville. Now, this is her eighth book. It's called Restless Dolly Maunder. And just before we discuss it, it's interesting to note that actually this is published by Canongate. So that's an independent publisher. It's nice to see independence there. And I note too that it's actually it's edited by Ella Wakatama. And I think the editors all have a very big role to play in this, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know how long Kate's been working with that particular editor. She's published many novels, as you say. She's previously been a winner of the Women's Prize, and I think she's also been shortlisted previously as well.
Mm. So the book, Restless Dolly Maunder.
It's based on the author's grandmother's life, and it begins on a sheep farm in New South Wales in 1881. And Dolly is a brilliant character. She fights constantly against the constraints that are placed on her as a woman in a man's world. And she pays a really high price for her nonconformity. She builds a business, she loses everything, she's forced to start over, but she never loses her fighting spirit, and we as judges, we all just fell in love with Dolly.
Isabella Hammond, this is only her second book, but she has been won many sort of awards previously for that first book, which was The Parisian. This one's called Enter Ghost. Tell us about it.
Well, it tells the story of Sonia, who is a British Palestinian actor who goes to visit her sister in Israel. I mean, actually to try to recover from a failed love affair. But while she's there, she's persuaded to join a local theatre troupe that's attempting to stage a production of Hamlet in Arabic in the West Bank. And it's just an exquisite piece of storytelling. It weaves history and politics and family with a really profound meditation on the purpose of art. I mean, you know, why bother staging a production of Hamlet in Arabic? And, you know, she asks really deep questions about that. It's nuanced, it's multi-layered, it's gorgeously written, and it's a fantastic achievement.
We come on to another Irish novelist like Anne Enright. This is Claire Kilroy. Her book is Soldier, Soldier. Tell us more.
So it's addressed to a new mother, by a new mother to her infant son. And she thinks of herself as a wounded soldier and as her little boy as a little sailor. And it examines unexpected grief about the life that she's lost. It explores kind of the brutal banalities of childcare and the overwhelming love that she experiences. It's raw, it's funny, it's angry. It's a novel that provokes a huge range of emotions in the reader, and we were all bowled over by it.
And the final book is actually a debut novel. Tell us about River East, River West.
It's set in Shanghai in the mid-2000s, and it opens with a wedding. 14-year-old Alva is absolutely horrified that her American mother, Sloane, is marrying Lu Fan, who's a local businessman. And the narrative then flips between Alva and Lu Fang and goes back in time, and it brings to life a whole sweep of Chinese history and society from the Cultural Revolution onwards. It's a book about reinvention. It's an inversion of the usual cross-cultural or immigrant story. And it's original, it's funny, and it's sometimes really heartbreaking as well.
And Monica, I know that the Women's Prize Trust do all sorts of events around these books. There's a fantastic email list that goes out and encourages people to join in various ways. It's a really a big way to get people reading and not just writing. And I know there's various other prizes. Of course, there's a non-fiction prize too now and various things for writers who are developing work. Just bringing all this together, for you as judges sitting there as a panel, how hard was it to make that choice of the final six?
Oh, it was incredibly tough. I mean, we had a fantastic long list of 16 novels, and getting it down to just six was really tough. But I'm incredibly proud of and excited about the six titles that we've chosen. I mean, of course, we all have to lose ones that we love along the way, but I think we've got the right shortlist in the end.
Monica Ali, thank you very much indeed. Monica is a writer and a judge of the Women's Prize for Fiction, and the final winner will be announced on June the 13th. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Tom Webb. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Georgina Godwin. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.